The next case is number 02-2869, Lute Garcia against the Village of Mount Prospect. Mr. Hunt.
May it please the court, Keith Hunt on behalf of Jose Garcia, the plaintiff appellant in this case. The district court in this case improperly dismissed the case based upon the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, because there were substantial differences between the relief that Mr. Garcia sought and what was at issue in the underlying case. Under the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, as it's been applied by this court in numerous cases, the court has to look beyond the four corners of the complaint and consider what the plaintiff was getting at in this case versus what the plaintiff had sought to get at in the prior case. In fact, some of the decisions out of this court have gone so far as to say that when the plaintiff in this case was the plaintiff in the underlying case, Rooker-Feldman does not apply. It would only apply to the defendant from the underlying case. In this situation,
res judicata would apply, though, isn't it? Right.
Well, we don't believe that res judicata bars Mr. Garcia's claims, but yes, Your Honor, under some of this court's decisions, if it's not a Rooker-Feldman analysis, then the court moves to the res judicata analysis. In this situation, Mr. Garcia, there are two elements to the Rooker-Feldman test: what he was seeking, and then whether he had the opportunity to have brought up that claim in the underlying case. And the second prong of that test really begins to address not only the Rooker-Feldman analysis, but also the res judicata analysis, because there is no contention, I believe, by either side that Mr. Garcia actually litigated in the state court case any claim of discrimination. Therefore, either under the Rooker-Feldman argument or under the res judicata analysis, the central issue becomes, could he have? Could Mr. Garcia have raised the issue of discrimination in that process? And there are several reasons why he could not. First, the issues about which he complains and the discrimination that he complains of did not arise until, or did not become perfected, he did not suffer any injury until the pension board had rendered its decision. But under the Administrative Review Act, the scope of the circuit court's analysis in that state law appeal is very limited. Section 3-110 of the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure provides that an administrative review can be brought only upon the record that was before the underlying administrative board. In this case,
he could have brought a 1983 claim in that court, though, couldn't he?
He could not. And the reason is this. I am familiar with this court's decisions in Manley, Durgan, and Davis, and I presume that's what the court is alluding to. But in those cases, although the court found that the plaintiff in those cases could have brought a 1983 action as part of the administrative review, in Manley, Durgan, and Davis, there was not a discrimination issue that was at the core of the plaintiff's federal action. Secondly, all of those cases were decided before the Fourth District Court of Appeals decision in Brewer, which we cite. Now, in Brewer versus Board of Trustees of the Fourth District Illinois case decided on June 17th of this year, that court, for the first time, and in the first decision of which we are aware, went and looked at the Geisy and Maksimovic analysis out of the Illinois Supreme Court and applied that specifically to a 1983 claim that was sought to be brought in that case. And because of the Brewer decision, because of the analysis involved in that decision, a plaintiff could not bring a 1983 action as part of the administrative review, at least where the gist of the 1983 action is predicated upon a claim of sexual harassment or race discrimination or something of that sort, as opposed to a situation where it's a 1983 claim based upon First Amendment or based upon some other allegation of constitutional deprivation. In this situation, Mr. Garcia could not have brought that as part of his administrative review. Had he would have been immediately confronted with the Illinois Supreme Court cases of Mitsinovic and Geisy, in which it has been clearly held by the Illinois Supreme Court that the circuit courts in Illinois lack jurisdiction. The cases on which this court decided or suggested that a 1983 action could be brought really were decided, the original cases were decided pre-1995 when the Geisy and Mitsinovic analysis took place by the Supreme Court. At a time when, in those during the earlier Seventh Circuit decisions, the conventional thinking was 1983 actions can be brought either in state court or in federal court. There's concurrent jurisdiction between the two between federal courts and state courts for those sorts of claims. And so why not? Why can't they be brought? We've seen an evolution in the Illinois law since that time that clarifies by the Supreme Court in Geisy and then again in Mitsinovic that the circuit court lacks jurisdiction according to Section 110C of the Illinois Human Rights Act to hear claims of discrimination. And for that reason, Mr. Garcia is barred from pursuing those claims and would have been barred from pursuing those claims. Given the fact that he did not have an opportunity to raise those claims and did not actually raise those claims, he cannot be barred in this case based upon res judicata, and he cannot be barred in this case by the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. Additionally, there are different parties that were involved in those cases, which is an element that is relevant to at least the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. In the underlying state court case, the only party that was part of the administrative review was the Mount Prospect Police Pension Board. Sergeant Steiner was not a defendant in that case, nor was he even a party. The Village of Mount Prospect was not a party in that case. And so given the fact that there are different parties in that case, it also bars the application of the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine.
Isn't the pension board really a creature of the village, the town?
It is, and it is not. It is true that the pension board, the pension board exists as a separate legal entity, although it is, in some sense, loosely related to the village. For example, the mayor makes the appointments of at least two people to the pension board, but three people he does not make the appointment.
Who makes the appointments with respect to them?
Two people are selected by the mayor and appointed by the mayor with the concurrence of the village board. Two members of the pension board are elected or chosen by the existing employees who are subject to that pension plan. And the fifth member is a retired pensionee, someone who has already received the pension and is selected from among those who have already received pensions.
Is this pursuant to state law?
It is. And we've cited the applicable statute in our brief that creates that. Because of that, and because of the state law governing how pension funds are administered and the tests which they must use, all say that they must act independently, they must act as a fiduciary. In those situations, it truly is a separate and distinct legal entity, a separate organization, and therefore simply having them in the case is not the same as having the village in the case. It certainly is not the same as having Sergeant Steiner in the case, although one of the things that I think is remarkable about this whole situation is the nature of the web that existed, the closely spun web, and the nature of the crossover between roles that existed in this case. Mr. Garcia, as we have alleged, was discriminated against, retaliated against based upon his participation in the Mount Prospect racial profiling case, based upon his testimony in that case, and specifically based upon his having called Sergeant Steiner a racist, as well as providing other testimony on which the district court relied in denying the village's motion for summary judgment in that case. Judge Williams handled the summary judgment of that case very shortly before she came to the Court of Appeals. At that same time, and when Mr. Garcia had his heart attack, on which his pension application was based, Steiner was on the board. Nicholson, Commander Nicholson, was also on the board. And in fact, both of these individuals took part in consideration of at least the first hearing that was held in connection with Mr. Garcia's pension application. Steiner was an individually named defendant in the Mount Prospect case, the Martinez case. He was the subject of an award of punitive damages based upon his violation of 1983 and his other civil rights violations. So we have at least two of the five members, the two current police members, who at the beginning of this process were the subject of Garcia's testimony, were the subject of a great deal of other testimony by other witnesses in the Martinez case, all of which said these people were racist, had grossly violated the rights of Hispanic officers who were employees, as well as other Hispanic
who communities. Who allegedly told your client he might as well not apply for this pension?
Steiner.
And then he was on the board?
He was on the board at the time.
You said at the beginning, was there a change in personnel at some point?
A change in personnel midway through the hearing process.
And Steiner was off at that point?
Steiner did not participate in the ultimate decision, although we have alleged in the complaint that he tainted the process and tainted the result by conferring with other board members or by influencing the outcome of the case. It's important to remember that one of the other claims that Garcia has made in this case is that not only did Steiner tell him not to apply, but when Garcia did apply for the duty-related disability pension, somehow Steiner managed to lose his medical records, delay the process, and essentially stall it, costing Garcia 8 months' worth of compensation. The other interesting participant in this whole process was Gannat. Now, Gannat did participate in the ultimate decision that was rendered by the pension board. Gannat, interestingly enough, is the white comparator that Garcia uses to say that he was treated differently based upon his race and that he was retaliated against. Gannat, 20 years earlier, had received a pension under remarkably identical circumstances to Garcia. Symptoms on the job, goes home, has a heart attack. He's given the disability pension. Garcia is not. Because Garcia did not have the opportunity to fully and fairly litigate these issues based upon the Brewer decision, the Geisey and Maksimovic decisions, and the Illinois law regarding the jurisdiction which circuit courts may exercise, this court should reverse the entry of summary judgment and remand the case for a hearing on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. We'll hear now from Mr. Gray.
Please, the court. Essentially, what we have here is the appellant asking this court to disregard years of precedent, the Perella case, the Davis case, the Manley case, the Lee case, all cases nearly identical to the facts before you, and to disregard the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Stratton to carve a new way to provide him another opportunity to litigate his case. On behalf of the Mount Prospect Pension Board, we respectfully ask that you affirm the court's decision and look to the years of precedent before you.
Are you arguing that it's Rooker-Feldman or res judicata?
We actually believe that there are grounds for both, Your Honor, although I believe that res judicata, frankly, is stronger. There is a great deal of confusion in some prior cases on the application of Rooker-Feldman, and I would look to the Perella and recently the Durgins case that, with cases directly on point and saying, although it's close, this type of situation in which you have an opportunity to have a hearing before pension board and then go to the Illinois Circuit Court and then challenge that circuit court review is really properly decided under res judicata rather than Rooker-Feldman.
Well, the injury here was antecedent to the lawsuit. The injury here is the act of discrimination.
The injury alleged is actually the pension board's decision. And that and the propriety of the pension board's decision is what was decided in the litigation before Judge Bush in the Illinois court, much like in the Perella case and in the Davis case. So similarly in the Durgins case, and frankly, Your Honors, there is a bit of confusion. In the Manley case, also very similar, in that situation they decided under Rooker-Feldman. We would submit that actually this should be, because the injury wasn't necessarily inflicted by Judge Bush in the state court, really as a matter of res judicata. I would add, though, that this is an argument that's going back and forth among several panels, but in the end, it really doesn't matter. The case is dismissed. Whether or not it's dismissed because of lack of jurisdiction pursuant to the Manley case, or it's dismissed on res judicata grounds pursuant to Perella or Davis or Lee, it gets dismissed nevertheless. Moving forward, I would like to address some comments made by Garcia's counsel saying that there's been a recent change in the law in the Brewer case. If we were to take a look at the Brewer case or the Geis case or the Maximovich case, they all are situations different than the ones before the court. They all are situations in which a plaintiff seeks to go directly to whether federal court or Illinois Circuit Court and allege a case under the Illinois Human Rights Act. And those cases stand for the proposition that the Illinois Human Rights Act have exclusive jurisdiction and prohibits that type of direct access. However, the Stratton case in 1990 decided by the Illinois Supreme Court had an exception. There's several exceptions to that, but the one that applies today is the exception that when you have an opportunity to have administrative review, whether it be pursuant to the Administrative Review Act or pursuant to a petition for cert, you have the right, and this court has later said actually the obligation, to add independent claims of discrimination and civil rights violations in that administrative review. There wasn't much talk in appellant's argument because that is the fatal flaw in the case. After going before the pension board and frankly getting a full hearing with depositions and lawyers, etc., they filed an appellate review for administrative review before the Illinois Circuit Court. Never raised these issues of discrimination. The Stratton case, this court's case in Durgins, Manley, Lee, Perella, all stand for the proposition that he had the obligation to raise these related claims before Judge Bush. He chose not to. Recently in the Durgins case, the court commented that litigants should not be permitted to have this piecemeal litigation where we'll try one round of review and if that doesn't work, we'll try a different court. And frankly, that's exactly what we have here today. And all of those cases that are cited both in the brief and in appellant's argument where Illinois cases or federal cases are citing the proposition that you cannot bring cases directly in the federal court or circuit court alleging claims of Illinois Human Rights Act, frankly, are inapposite and are not relevant to this decision before the court today. There's another case that...
Does the additional claim have to be sent back to the administrative agency to be exhausted?
The administrative claim is gone under res judicata and the doctrine of merger. He had the right, as this court recently said in Durgins, he had the obligation because it was the same parties, the Mount Prospect Pension Board and Garcia, and the same issue of whether or not this gentleman should have gotten a duty pension or a non-duty pension. He was still provided, by the way, a non-duty pension of 50%. But because of the same parties and same operative facts, the doctrine of merger applied, and therefore it should not be sent back, Your Honor.
You're bringing the additional claim of discrimination in the circuit court. Now, is the Circuit Court decide that as an original matter, or do they remand it to an administrative agency?
They decide it as an original matter, and that's what the Stratton Court looked at, that precise issue. The Illinois Supreme Court looked at this issue and said those type of related claims, those independent claims, must be appended to the Circuit Court complaint and then decided by the Circuit Court. So the heart and soul of appellant's arguments really fail here, because he's had his day in court. He had an opportunity to first litigate before the pension board and then to litigate in state court. And whether it be under the doctrine of Rooker-Feldman, or we would assert more appropriately under the doctrine of res judicata, it's important to not allow litigants to sort of hold back and pull punches, wait to see how the results come out, and then try again in a different form. I also would like to address a situation about whether or not he was limited to the record. Comments were made by Garcia's counsel. The same cases that we've been talking about, the Seventh Circuit line of precedent, all of which that were based on the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Stratton, say that, Your Honor, when you have that opportunity to bring the independent claim and append it to the administrative review claim, you are not limited to the record. The cases that he cites, Crabtree, Comito, are talking about situations where you're simply alleging an administrative review. Then we would agree, if the case before the Circuit Court is only administrative review, then you're bound by the record. However, the courts have been clear in this situation, saying that when you append that additional case, you have a right to bring additional evidence before the Circuit Court. And so, contrary to the statements made by the appellant in both the brief and in argument, they not only had the ability, but they were, as this court recently said in Durgan, they must have had brought forth the additional evidence on the independent claim. I would also like to address another issue raised by appellant's counsel, I think for the first time actually, an argument concerning the relationship between the pension board and the Village of Mount Prospect. In a few minutes, you'll be hearing from an attorney from the village who may speak at length at this, but I did want to bring something to your Honor's opinion. The comments made by counsel, unfortunately, are directly inconsistent with the ones alleged in the complaint. You will note, though, we never got this far because of the res judicata issue. But in the end, that this is a Title VII 1983 case where the plaintiff has attempted to tie in his complaint, the Village of Mount Prospect and the Mount Prospect Pension Board, so he could have an employer under Title VII. So in his own complaint in this action, it alleged in paragraph 12, which is in the appendix, the Mount Prospect Police Pension Board is an agent of the Village of Mount Prospect. And then he goes on at length to try to tie those entities together to try to establish a link between them, so the employer, Village of Mount Prospect, is tied to the decision maker, the pension board.
Is there an independent allegation made against the village?
There's an independent, well, there's no independent allegations made in this lawsuit, Your Honor. They're all tied together, and they tie the village with the Mount Prospect Pension Board. And I would also add, with respect to Mr. Steiner was voluntarily dismissed at the beginning of this litigation. It's really not at issue here today, but there's no separate allegations against the village for the same reason I was just commenting, that it was important for him to try to tie in the village and the pension board.
Thank you, Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Hill. Mr. Hill, maybe you could start off by answering the question I just asked your colleague, and I think it's rather key. Are there independent claims made in this complaint against your client as opposed to the pension board?
No, not as I review counts 1 through 4 and count 7 of the complaint. I don't believe they are independent. The claims all arise out of the pension board's action, and then each of those four counts, or five counts, arise out of the pension board's action in denying the 65% on-duty disability pension. Now, he makes allegations of discrimination against certain village employees at that time, Steiner, and I suppose indirectly you could say he makes an allegation against Nicholson, and they were village employees, but all of the counts that remain in the complaint, or remained in the complaint at the time Judge Bucklow entered her decision, arise solely out of the pension board's decision not to grant the disability pension. There is no count which says the village of Mount Prospect is guilty of discriminating against Jose Garcia because of the actions of its employees or any kind of Monell claim here. This is all what the pension board did. The only way he pulls the village in at all is through these, through what the pension board did in fact do, and his allegations of discrimination surrounding the pension board. And I hope that that answers the question with respect to that. While we are here having a motion for summary judgment that was granted, contested, and I realize that all facts pleaded in the complaint must be taken as true, please distinguish, as I know you will, what is pleaded in the complaint with the statements that Mr. Hunt made here today on behalf of Jose Garcia with respect to all of the things that he claims has happened in Mount Prospect with respect to discrimination. Many of those facts have nothing to do with the complaint and are inaccurate. For instance, he said that George Steiner had a judgment, a punitive damages judgment against him while he was sitting on the board of farm or the pension board. That isn't true. There were some officers of the police department in Mount Prospect who did have that. George Steiner was not one of them. This entire case is about the failure of the pension board to grant a line of duty pension. The claim is that it wasn't awarded because there were discriminatory acts that took place with respect to the hearing and the ultimate decision. Mr. Hunt claims and argues to this court in the face of a line of cases that numbered in the dozen, as much as many as 12, he argues in the face of those cases that the issues of discrimination, 1983 claims, Title VII claims, could not have been raised before the Mount Prospect Pension Board. He says that those cases are wrong. I think Mr. Gray has answered adequately his Mr. Hunt's interpretation of the Brewer case. Those are Brewer, and the cases that came before it are all direct access cases. They have nothing to do with bringing up discrimination when it is ancillary to other claims on administrative review. Virtually all of the claims of discrimination that Mr. Garcia makes arise out of facts, if they were true, that happened during or before the Police Pension Board held its hearing. He could have raised those issues under this whole line of cases. Those cases are so pervasive in Illinois law that one must assume that Mr. Garcia made a tactical decision not to raise them at that time. The fact of discrimination inherent in the decision of the pension board that he alleges and says, well, we couldn't have raised that because the decision hadn't been made yet. That could have been raised under all of these cases before Judge Bush. Once again, he made a tactical decision not to do so. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt, you had 2 minutes. Perhaps, Mr. Hunt, you could begin by answering the question I posed to your colleagues. What is, if anything, the independent allegation against the village here, or are you simply arguing that the pension board was the in effect, their agent with respect to the adjudication of the pension?
I think we're arguing essentially both. Number one, that the pension board did act as a arm of the village, but at the same time, there were independent acts by people like Nicholson or Steiner for which the village could be vicariously liable.
Such as?
Such as all of the conduct that we've alleged by Steiner, holding up the claim, losing, which we contend was done intentionally, the medical records. And so there are independent acts of wrongdoing by their employees, which we believe are attributable to them. I wanted to correct a couple things. If I did misspeak and say that Steiner was had a judgment entered against him, I was incorrect. I heard Mr. Hill point that out. It was Nicholson who had the judgment entered against him. I would also note that in order for this court to adopt the defendant Appellee's reasoning regarding the Manley, Durgan, and Davis cases would necessarily mean that you would have the very untenable situation in the Illinois state courts that a person could not sue directly, but could, under certain circumstances, bring such a claim indirectly. And I think it's a fundamental principle that a plaintiff cannot do indirectly that which it cannot do directly. In other words, if a plaintiff can't bring a suit directly in front of the circuit court, then it cannot do that indirectly as well. I would also note that none of those cases ever relied upon Stratton. Stratton wasn't even cited in any of those cases, and because Stratton, may I finish this point very briefly?
Please.
Because Stratton was a common law writ of cert case, not an administrative review case, the same rules regarding the circumscope of the record did not apply. The court in Stratton was allowed to go beyond the actual record there because it was a common law cert case and it was based upon general equitable principles. That does not apply here.
I think we have the point. Thank you, sir. Indeed, our thanks not only to Mr. Hunt, but to Mr. Gray, Mr. Hill. These are difficult issues. I thought the briefs were particularly good. And thanks for the help. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.